Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, let's see. What do we got today? We got how the big banks are a little bit like your local Chinese restaurant. We've got how cable and satellite TV companies get consumers to bite every single time. And the big shakeup in the mattress business. Seriously. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is the 12th of March. Great, as always, to have you with us on a Thursday, everybody. We've been talking a lot the whole past couple of days on this program of the foreign exchange markets, of the rising dollar and the falling everything else. Seems natural, then, to follow up with this. What does one do with one's dollars and euros and yen once the trades are finished? One puts them in the bank, is what one does, which is why the Federal Reserve's bank stress tests this week are where we will start. Two European outfits, Deutsche Bank and Santander, flat out failed the tests. Three of the American banks, that'd be Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, and Morgan Stanley, just squeaked by. And Bank of America got sent back with a big fat redo. None of the banks here in the States flunked outright. But those passing grades, well, they are a little bit like the ones that restaurants get from the local health inspector. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn explains.
If the stress test was a restaurant health inspection, it would happen randomly, or when someone calls in a complaint, like in the movie Ratatouille.
Health inspector.
I wish to report a rat infestation.
Compared to that, the stress tests are much more predictable.
Kent Smetters is a professor at the Wharton School. He says it's fine the banks know the inspection dates and even the names of inspectors in advance because he can't really fake a bank balance sheet.
Whereas a restaurant, if they actually knew when the inspector was coming, they could actually have unclean floors and unsanitary conditions.
And just hose it down at the right moment. Banks have to clear a slightly higher bar, proving they can weather a simulated financial disaster. That's like a kitchen proving it can survive a hurricane. But that do-over Bank of America has to do, analyst Mike Mayo says that suggests a problem with the process.
It would be similar to going to a restaurant and saying, the food tastes good, the service is fine, and then you walk back in the kitchen and you see somebody's using their hands with fingernails that are unclean.
That kind of offense might immediately shut down the Chinese restaurant down the street. Banks get a second chance.
Yes, well, look, if the Chinese restaurant down the street were part of an enormous firm that was supplying 20% of all food to all Americans, I think it would be a different conversation.
MIT professor Simon Johnson says American regulators tend to treat the big banks with kid gloves because they're so big and complicated and interconnected. But it's that complexity that makes it hard to predict their vulnerabilities.
The task for the Fed is like going to look at a country and trying to understand all the dimensions of a country and how it all fits together and where the risk could come from.
And the barely passing grades for those four American banks? In his opinion, that's like the health department giving a restaurant the grade just above giving people food poisoning. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Oh, good. Food poisoning, right? All right, moving on. Opening up the Marketplace file folder of statistics that will scare you today, there is this. Survival rates for some high-risk surgeries can vary by as much as 23% depending on what hospital you go to. That's from a new report from the patient safety organization, the Leapfrog Group. From the Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has more on that.
Dr. Tom Varghese, a surgeon at the University of Washington, says there's good reason why a patient dies when you remove some or all of his esophagus. He's often weak and malnourished. He's gone through chemotherapy and radiation, and now Varghese is about to cut him open to perform, let's face it, a tough procedure.
So you take out the esophagus, then you have to reconstruct the replacement, which most often is going to be the stomach.
Varghese says he performs maybe 15 of these surgeries every year. In all, the Leapfrog group looked at four risky surgeries, including esophagectomies, as well as replacing the aortic valve in the heart and removing some or all of the pancreas. The study found, in general, the hospitals that performed these procedures the most tended to have the best outcomes. That's no surprise, says Dr. Bob Wachter at the University of California, San Francisco.
There's clear evidence that practice does make perfect. The more cases you do in general, the better you are.
The hospital matters, too. Does the facility report their mortality and readmission rates? Do staff wash their hands? Do nurses feel comfortable calling a doctor at 3 a.m.? All of those questions play a role in patient quality. The trouble's been it's hard to find reliable information, says Leapfrog's Erica Mobley.
healthcare hasn't really been held to the standards of other industries of having to publicly report information, both the good and the bad. And that's really starting to change.
Mobley says here's what hospitals need to know. In a recent survey, consumers said what disturbed them the most was not high infection rates or leaving an object inside a patient. It was when hospitals withheld information and failed to report data. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
You remember a couple of weeks ago when the Federal Communications Commission voted to approve new rules on net neutrality? Well, if you had a hankering to read the actual rules themselves, today is your lucky day, people. The FCC put them online this morning, all 400 pages worth. We've got a link to it on our website if you are one of those people. It is, of course, marketplace.org. For the foreign exchange aficionados among you, the dollar-euro trade today was about $1.06 to the single currency, since that's where we started. It's a tad weaker for the greenback than yesterday. On Wall Street today, pretty good. Actually, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Ten years ago this spring, Alan Greenspan, then, of course, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States, said he wasn't so much worried about a big housing bubble. He was worried about a lot of local housing bubbles. He said the market had a lot of froth in it. That is his word, by the way. We all do know how that turned out. But 10 years on, the often cited Case-Shiller Home Price Index says that in 2014, home prices grew at about twice the rate of inflation. In theory, growth enough to sustain a broad-based housing recovery. But much like the froth before the crash, the comeback is affecting different communities in different ways. Black and Hispanic communities in particular, where buyers were more likely to be carrying subprime mortgages. From the suburbs of Atlanta, Georgia, Marketplace's Noel King has more.
Hi, Robin. I'm Noel.
Nice to see you. Thank you so much. I saw the car drive.
The Chapel Lake subdivision is in suburban DeKalb County, just east of Atlanta. The winding streets have names like Autumn Lake and Arbor Place. Large homes sit on big lawns. Chapel Lake looks like a suburban paradise for the professional class. And Robin O'Neill, a 17-year resident who works in real estate, says it kind of is.
We have teachers, we have nurses, we have engineers, you have computer programmers here, we have doctors in here, maybe a couple of lawyers also.
Robin says most residents are African American, members of Atlanta's large black middle and upper middle class. As she stands on the lawn in front of her pale yellow house, she can see ripples from the recession and the housing crash.
The house right in front of me was a distressed property, and it was on the market for right at $77,000, I think. It's a three-bedroom, and the house right next door, which is larger, it was also up for sale for $79,000.
O'Neill bought her four-bedroom house in 1997 for $168,000. She says today it's worth about $150,000, but she has faith.
We are bouncing back, so it just takes a little time. So it's just going to take some time for us to fully come back, I believe. But I think we'll get there.
But some new research shows that Chapel Lake and other African-American neighborhoods like it aren't fully coming back. Dan Immergluck is the researcher.
I'm professor of city and regional planning at Georgia Tech. I've been following housing markets in Atlanta since I came here 10 years ago.
And since about 2012, he'd been hearing about Metro Atlanta's recovery. But then he'd see neighborhoods where lots of houses were still vacant or boarded up.
I was frustrated with the local media coverage, always talking about the market as a whole recovering and doing well and prices going up and inventory being low.
So Immergluck looked at Greater Atlanta by zip code. Using home price estimates from the real estate website Zillow from 2001 on, he looked at how each zip code was recovering. And he found that even if he controlled for the types of houses, he used three-bedroom places, there were big differences. Around half,
what folks might call the favored half, they have really seen dramatic wealth increases in housing values despite the recession.
Another third,
they have started to see a little bit of recovery, but they're still 35 to 40% below the value that they were at in the year 2001.
Those in the favored half tend to be majority white. Those that have only recovered partially are majority African American and or Hispanic.
we found that race of a neighborhood, and particularly whether it's African American, was a strong predictor of its housing recovery since the crisis.
Immer Gluck says part of the reason is that African-American homeowners were more likely to have subprime loans, more likely to have lost their houses, and that has left some majority black neighborhoods scarred, even if the scars don't always show.
So what I'm seeing are lovely single-family homes, nice cars. That's a Mercedes that we just passed.
I took a drive through one of the partial recovery zip codes with Dorothy Brown, a professor at Emory University School of Law, who studies the intersection of race and class.
You know, you always look around and go, there's the bad house in the neighborhood. There is no bad house in the neighborhood.
She says Immer Gluck's findings reflect that there can be a kind of financial penalty for buying in a black neighborhood in good times or bad.
Studies show the race of your neighbors will have a lot to do with the appreciation of the home you live in.
She says take two neighborhoods that are identical, except for the race of residents. Homes in the black neighborhood will probably be valued less than homes in the white neighborhood. So is she advising against buying in black neighborhoods? She's not, but...
Be smart. Be intentional. Make sure you are not expecting your net worth to come solely from your home in a way that most blacks have their net worth tied up in their homes because they've bought into this American dream that once you buy a home, you're set for life.
Back in Chapel Lake, Robin O'Neill is also unsurprised by Immer Gluck's findings.
I'm sure you've heard the expression, when America gets a cold, black America gets the flu.
But she says there's a bright side, too. You can buy in a place like Chapel Lake and get a whole lot of house for your money. In Atlanta, I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's a fairly simple product when you get down to it. It's not a cell phone. It's not a battery. It's not a car.
No, it's a mattress. And if it's so simple, by the way, why does it cost so much? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 259 points today, about 1.5%, closed at 17,895. The Nasdaq jumped 43 points, 0.9%. 48.93 there. The S&P 500 gained 25 points, 1.25%, 2,065 at the bell. Financials did pretty well. Morgan Stanley advanced 0.6% today. Same thing with Citigroup. It rose about 0.33%. American Express up 2.75%. Stress tests, people, stress tests. Walt Disney twinkled up 4.1% today. Disney said it's going to release 3 Star Wars movies during the next 2 years and 11 more Marvel Comics movies over the next 4 years. I still don't, by the way, understand how you have a standalone Star Wars film, but maybe that's just me. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.11%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues the Producer Price Index for February. The International Energy Agency releases its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the globe. And on March 13, 1781, we learned that our solar system was a little bigger when Uranus was discovered. 1 year on that planet is about 84 years on this one. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There was a lawsuit filed in the U.S. District Court out in San Francisco yesterday that's going to be of interest to a whole lot of television watchers out here. The Federal Trade Commission is going after DirecTV for, in essence, advertising one price and charging another. That what customers saw advertised and what they ultimately paid were not the same thing. DirecTV, for its part, says people knew exactly what they were buying. There are lots of companies offering deals in the cable and satellite television business, but trying to figure out which are deals and which aren't, yeah, that's where it gets complicated. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has more.
Follow me to the great state of New Hampshire, where it's still winter, but that's beside the point. James Buffetti runs New Hampshire Attorney General's Consumer Protection Bureau, and he says pay TV companies register among the top 10 most complained about businesses.
People have complaints about the advertising of promotional packages, and they don't actually find that that's what they're being charged by the company.
Buffetti says a lot of these complaints get resolved, and they're usually misunderstandings between consumer and company. And he says to break the law, companies have to be more willful.
a lack of disclosure about significant terms in a business deal could be unfair or deceptive.
The Federal Trade Commission is basically accusing DirecTV of doing something like that, that the fine print in their promotional offers was too fine. DirecTV denies that.
We certainly are in an era of increasingly complex offers.
Ian Olgerson of SNL Kagan says that applies across the board in the industry. Part of his job is to regularly comparison shop between pay TV providers. And he says even he, an analyst, gets confused.
It is difficult to gain absolute clarity on a customer service call as to what your bill will be.
One of the reasons for this, says Laura Martin of Needham & Company, is that pay TV providers themselves are paying more for all those channels.
So we're getting margin pressure in the video part of the business as programming costs rise faster than prices can be passed through to consumers.
So expect those promotional offers to keep on coming. As for our bills, we'll have to keep a close eye on them. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
Here's a point you've heard before on this program, but that bears repeating nonetheless. Some of the fastest growing economies in the world are in Asia. And with all that growth comes more money, more jobs, and more people, which means cities are getting bigger, a whole lot bigger. In Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam, little can stand in the way of all that urban sprawl, not even the dead. The city's biggest cemetery is set to be turned into a shopping mall and pricey apartments and parks as well. Moving 70,000 tombs is, yes, a challenge. Here's another one, though. Figuring out what to do with hundreds of people who live and work inside the cemetery. Here's Christopher Johnson from Ho Chi Minh City.
Binh Hung Hoa Cemetery is a relatively quiet place to lay flowers, light incense at a loved one's grave, even say a solemn prayer. And hey, before you leave, grab a massage. A masseuse named Mun says she's offering oil, full body, hand and head treatments for very cheap, less than $5 an hour. It's kind of a steal if you're okay with a rubdown among nearly 200 football fields worth of above ground cement tombs. Mun says her customers couldn't care less.
Many local people who have colds, the flu, or fever often come here. There's been a big community living here for years and years.
Since before the early 60s, when a much smaller cemetery first opened here. After the U.S. war ended, the whole place just got bigger. More graves, and today, hundreds of people. Tee Cook Nguyen and her husband live here, where they work sweeping and looking after nearly 1,000 tombs. They start before dawn, and apparently there's just one person here who's a little bit creeped out about that.
Are you scared of ghosts? No ghosts here, only bodies. Their spirits are up in heaven already, so I feel totally peaceful living here.
The Catholic Church hired the couple almost 25 years ago. Nguyen says this gig sure beats her old job selling produce.
Visitors often thank me as they see that I'm taking care of their families' tombs. I make $100 to $150 a month, and I have more freedom. I really enjoy taking care of the graves.
There are other ways to earn cash here. Some rent out rooms to day laborers. Others run makeshift speakeasies. Want to order a whole roasted pig? One of the temple caretakers will hook you up. Hua Bing runs a small stand parked at a crossroads inside the cemetery, where she sells sweet iced coffee, plus flowers and incense for the graves. Things have been tough for her since 2011, when the District People's Committee closed the cemetery to new burials. Families came and started emptying the tombs, and since then, she says business, well, it's been kind of like a graveyard around here.
As soon as they started removing the tombs, the number of visitors dropped a lot. There used to be 500 tombs in this area. Sometimes there would be a line of cars here just to visit one tomb, you know? But it's getting quiet, very quiet.
Quiet? Not exactly. The cemetery sits just 2 miles from Ho Chi Minh City's very busy international airport. This is where it's supposed to happen. Luxury apartments, a shopping mall, maybe a park, all by the year 2020. Partly, yes, it is about sprawl, but there are public health issues too, says Yale anthropologist Eric Harms, who's written about urban redevelopment here in Ho Chi Minh City.
There's been a lot of stories about people drinking water from wells there. Like, that's pretty nasty, right? To drink water from a well in a cemetery where corpse juices are dripping into the well, right?
Some of those who live here are actually embracing the new plans. Harms says that with projects like this one, people often imagine a more comfortable way of life.
Well, they say, yeah, it'd be nice to have a nice house or live in an apartment building with air conditioning or, clean sewer systems, good schools for the kids. That's, in some sense, perhaps preferable to living in a cemetery.
But the local government hasn't said what it's going to do for the folks who live here. It's tricky in part because many people don't have any legal claims to the land. One thing is clear, soon they'll have to pack up and move on as this old graveyard gets set to start a new life. In Vietnam, I'm Christopher Johnson for Marketplace.
Other than a car, what's the worst single product shopping experience you can think of? Well, you could probably think of lots, truth be told, but buying a new mattress has to be near the top of the list, right? Prices are crazy, options are bewildering, and don't even get me started on delivering the thing. But other than trudging down to the local mattress store, what options do we have? Turns out, we got plenty of options. Kyle Stock wrote about the new thing in mattress shopping for Bloomberg Business. Kyle, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Fair to say, I think that the mattress business is an industry ripe for disruption.
It is. It's very consolidated. It's a very stable business. You know, these mattresses are sold in traditional stores. You know the drill. You go and you lay down. Lay down another one, lay down another one, try to make a decision.
And then it gets weird and you just buy the one to get it done with, right?
Exactly. And the line between, you know, valid and very cool innovation and marketing is impossible to see.
Right. The pillow top versus the foam, whatever it is, versus the, you know, Expedic, whatever, right?
I mean, there are differences between them. What gets tricky is these companies will name the same mattress 4, 5, 8 different ways. So each store will be able to say, we have the exclusive to the cushion top maple leaf or whatever you want to call it. When really it's the same as something just across the street. But that makes it incredibly hard to comparison shop and do your research.
Tell me about these companies that you profile in this piece. They are basically doing to this mattress industry, you say, what Warby Parker did for glasses.
Right. It's sort of the classic e-commerce disruption recipe. Sourcing a pretty simple product, but a good one. Cutting out the middleman, skipping the store leases, and then doing a great job with the website, marketing, customer service. And there's a ton of them. There's at least 6 to 8 of them now that have come up in the past 2 years.
And they are selling mattresses for plus or minus $800, whereas you can walk in and buy a Tempur-Pedic for like $3,000.
Yeah. And that's sort of the value proposition. They say it's a mattress on par with a $2,000 or $3,000 mattress that you'd find in a store.
What's the deal? Is it just better foam or I mean, how does it?
From what I can tell, they're about the same as what you'd find in a store. It is all foam, but suppliers have gotten really good at making this foam. They literally press it out like a giant block of cheese and then it's just cut.
Ugh.
Each company has a different recipe for how they layer it and how dense it is or soft it is. It's a fairly simple product when you get down to it. It's not a cell phone. It's not a battery. It's not a car.
I go online, I order my mattress, and then how does it show up at my door? I mean, because mattress delivery, man, is notoriously painful. I mean,
right.
We barely got the one I have in my house upstairs for crying out.
Yeah, yeah. So leaving the springs out is kind of the magic in the thing. They can then sort of compress it and smush all the air out of it and fit it in a box that's about the size of a large appliance, say a washing machine. And then that ships to you. It comes with a little razor blade to cut the thing open. And then it just, you know, poofs into shape like a kid's toy.
Well, speaking of kids, is this going to stand up to my kids jumping on it?
It probably will, yeah. I mean, they won't get as much air out of a play session, but they're nice.
Kyle Stock, he's a writer at Bloomberg, writes this week on mattresses and the new way to do them. Kyle, thanks very much.
Thanks, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, in which human ingenuity might just prove to be the end of us. The Associated Press is reporting that the federal government has approved powdered alcohol for sale. It's called Palcohol. It's apparently freeze-dried alcohol packed in small, easy-to-carry pouches. You can get it in vodka, rum, cosmopolitan, margarita, and lemon drop flavors. Left unexplained is why. No, I'm just kidding. I get why.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
Wall Street liked this Thursday very much, thanks. The Dow up 259 points today, about 1.5%. The NASDAQ gained 43 points, 0.9%. The S&P 500 got itself 25 points higher, 1.25%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Nancy Fargali, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.